everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 180 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Older and Wiser. Insight from Money Farm founder Mike Krueger, too. I've talked about this before, but it's worth a mention again. Often, when I'm in the midst of interviewing a guest, I'm listening to the answers, but I'm also anticipating the next question, which not only diverts my full attention, but it makes it impossible to enjoy the conversation completely. As a result, it's frequently only when I'm producing the podcast, which involves listening to it several times, that I can truly appreciate not just what the speaker is saying, but indeed how he or she is saying it. Because presentation matters. Those old enough to remember me from my reporting days at the Capitol Press might recall the reporter who stood up in meetings and asked tough questions. What you didn't know, however, is that I was frequently quaking in my boots when I did it. Although I'm not a born speaker myself, this podcast has made me an observer of those who do appear to be born speakers, as well as those who are less gifted. Those born to the skill require little editing. On my production software, I can watch the voice print of individuals and the delivery of those who speak well look like discrete packages of information. It is my belief, as I listen to Krueger, that he became successful in his commodity marketing advisory service not because he was so much better than anybody else in predicting market moves. It was because he was so much better at talking about his market move predictions. In the second part of our conversation from May 15, 2020, I began by asking Krueger what was important to him when looking at U.S. Department of Agriculture reports like the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate called WASD, which was released on May 12th.
The first things I typically do when I look at a supply and demand report is I always look at, depending on the time of the year, but certainly the harvested acreage number and the yield estimates, because of course that gets you to production. But the really important parts, once that's kind of in place, is what are they doing with demand? So I immediately go to export demand. In the case of wheat, you know, because for wheat we need to export almost 50% of what we produce. And in the case of feed grains, you have to look at what they're doing with the feed residual number. And that's a difficult number because it's not reported. You know, we can only kind of go from one quarterly stocks report to the next quarterly stocks report, take out what we know has been exported or processed, and the balance of usage almost has to be feed. So I look at those components really pretty quickly. Then I automatically, in the case of wheat, for example, I will go to the major wheat exporting countries, you know, Australia, Argentina, Canada, of course, Russia, the EU, and occasionally the Ukraine. See what adjustments, if any, the USDA has made to their expectations for their supply and demand issues in terms of both production and, importantly, whether they're increasing or decreasing, you know, their export forecasts. I don't know if there's any special magic or science to that. It's just how I developed over the years, and I would guess how I was trained. And, you know, some things, if you're in the flow every day, stick out, like the ethanol number on corn that I mentioned earlier. They raised the ethanol production estimate for next year. And here we sit in the most recent weekly ethanol production report. We use 62 million bushels of corn in ethanol, and we need to use a little bit over 100 million bushels of corn a week to meet the USDA projection. So when we're, you know, down 35-40% from where we need to be, it just seems unusual that they'd raise the ethanol forecast.
So the WASD report suggested that the season average price for wheat would be $4.60 a bushel. Can farmers make a profit at $4.60? And do you think there will be opportunities to sell for a dollar more than that during this marketing year, or will it just be pennies?
You know, of course, the answer to the first question, can farmers make money on it, depends on who you are and where you are. But just as a general across-the-board rule, let's look at North Dakota for an example. So let's assume that a 65 bushel wheat yield at 460 will generate about $300 Let me do the math. About $250 an acre, $255 an acre. I think almost across the board, any extension service will tell you that the variable cost to plant hard red spring wheat in the Northern Plains is right around $150 an acre. Feed, fertilizer, seed, chemicals, you know, fuel. I think it's very difficult in the Northern Plains to rent farmland for much less than $120 an acre, and for a while it was going for $150 to $200 an acre in the eastern half. So to answer your question, if your expenses are $300 an acre or so, and your income is $250, no, you can't make any money out of it. Your part of the world, Pacific Northwest, is better off. Number one, your yields are better typically than ours, although this year you might have a little bit of an issue. And secondly, of course, your prices are higher because we pay an additional dollar a bushel freight to get hard red spring wheat from North Dakota out to the ports in Portland or Seattle. So, no, wheat doesn't pencil out today, and it really hasn't all winter long as I followed these crop budget worksheets. Secondly, am I optimistic that we can get a rally of a dollar a bushel on wheat? You know, part of me says we can, but here's what it'll take. Number one, Canada can't have a record crop. Number two, we hope that the Black Sea wheat production tails off a little bit. They've been dry, so Ukraine started to drop their production numbers this week. There is some rain going to hit over that area. I don't know how much. Thirdly, it would be really helpful if the dollar backed off even just a little bit. You know, a 70 cent or whatever it is Australian dollar and a 75 cent Canadian dollar just is a real problem for U.S. farmers. But I think the real key is that if China follows through on their phase one agreement, I think that would mean that they could buy potentially 8 to 10 million tons of corn, up to 400 million bushels, and I think 4 to 5 million tons of wheat, which is 200 million bushels of wheat. And I think that would make a difference. And I'm talking buying U.S. wheat. I think we could get the U.S. wheat carryout down to that 650 to 750 million bushels. We've been at a billion or so the last couple of years. But I think that's what it would take. I also think it would be helpful if China, of course, followed through and bought soybeans, that, you know, because that would, the U.S. soybean situation is not as heavy nearly as it was 2 years ago, not nearly as heavy as corn. Wheat's problem is going to be how big this corn anchor might be. So we need China to help us out in the corn market, or obviously, and we hate to say it, we need to not have a record corn yield. I would not be a seller of wheat today, Scott. I would be patient.
Okay. All right. So earlier when we were talking about USDA numbers, you also talked about other analysts. And I assume that when you're devising marketing plans for farmers back in the past before you retired, USDA was only one source of information. Where else did you turn to get information to make your decisions?
Well, a lot of the information that I used was just, you know, personal contacts that I had over the years. One of the real benefits of these speaking gigs around the world and around the U.S. is that, you know, you make contacts every place. So I don't have to read a news story about what's happening with West Australia's wheat crop. I stayed with farmers over there on numerous times. I can call them, email them, text them, and say, tell me exactly what's going on. So personal contact helped a lot. The industry contacts helped a lot. But also, we would read other publications. International Grains Council out of London, you know, we'd look at their numbers just for reference points. Certainly, we'd look at Informa's numbers for reference points. We would look at the various exchanges around the world that would put out numbers regularly just so we had to see if we weren't getting too far off of the beaten path or what other people were thinking. And I think to a large extent, all of those sources today are probably easier to use than when they were 10 or 15 years ago, just because of what we're doing now, right? The Zooming and the instant communications and all those sorts of things. News travels much, much more quickly. It's just a question of determining what news is worthy and what news is fake news.
As I'm sitting here listening to you, Mike, I'm thinking to myself, I was a liberal arts major too. But
hey, there you go.
I can't imagine transitioning from that to what you do or did. Were there any advantages to having a liberal arts education to coming into marketing commodities?
Well, I think back in the day when Cargill, for example, was recruiting liberal arts people, I think their feeling was, look, we don't want preconceived ideas on agricultural economics or how basis works or all those analytical data points or whatever. What we want is somebody who we know has a broader, a broader horizon, a broader scope, no preconceived ideas, is willing to, maybe sometimes think outside the box. Not sure they entirely got that with me, but I think that was their idea. And I also think the thing that really helped me, Scott, over through all the years was that because, I could read, I could write, I was okay at speaking, that the communications end of it really bolstered me as much as anything. I mean, I was not afraid to get up in front of a group and talk and take questions and but you had to know what you were talking about or that didn't work very well either.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Okay. Did you get better at marketing over time? And is there any sort of yardstick to measure that?
I don't know if there's a yardstick. I think that, interestingly enough, I had a great friend who passed away a couple of years ago. He was between 85 and 90 years of old in the grain business his entire life. Worked for Continental Grain, started his own company in New York City after that. Was one of the first people to export U.S. durum to the Middle East back in the 60s and early 70s. But in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the computers took over, my friend Bill said to me one day, he said, 25-year-olds today have a distinct advantage over you and I who have 30, 40, 50 years of history in the market because they're not burdened by that history. They're into who's moving markets today, funds, charts, graphs, technicals, money flow. So someday, I've always thought about that, thinking, maybe that was a handicap because I would see, or at least I would think I would see, trends way earlier than people who are trading the market, and I would react earlier and get kicked, and then 3 months later, it would all come to fruition. To me, the measure of whether I was sort of successful or not was, did my clients stick with me? And like I said, I still have a lot of clients who call, email, whatever, text, just to get my opinion, and that's been valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the kind of marketing that you were doing, was it mostly near-term stuff? And by that, I mean, whether a farmer should sell this week or next, or was it big picture stuff in terms of, I wouldn't plant corn next year, I wouldn't plant wheat next year, or something like that?
It was mostly big picture stuff, Scott. We would start, months ago, kind of prepping potential supply and demand scenarios for 6, 12, 18 months out. Just to kind of see what the lay of the land was and then start to tell our clients, look, I'm not, just as you said, I wouldn't be planting corn this year. I think you should move here, move there. These might be the markets that react better. And for those, everybody's got limited rotations. If you have to plant spring wheat or you have to plant corn, then based on what we think today, let's say in January, we think you ought to be selling 10, 15, 20% of your new crop production just to kind of get some on the books at what we know is a decent price. Also, I have to say, one of the tenets off and on of marketing plans was always know your cost of production, so you know when to sell, when you can make money. Well, there are years when your cost of production isn't going to be met by marketing, so it becomes an issue of maybe we make sales to limit our losses, not to maximize our profits. Which is a hard concept, but think about that. If farmers planting corn have $400 or $500 in total input costs, and corn's at 320, and we think it's going to go to 260, even though you're not making money at 320, maybe you ought to sell some, just because mm-hmm. you're going to limit your losses. But we took a longer term view, and then in the short term, we watch things like basis levels and those issues to trigger more short term cash sales.
We're talking a little bit about corn here, and I'm curious, North Dakota was not known as a corn state 20 years ago, and now, you got a lot of corn. How did your business change over the years? Have you gone from, 80% wheat, 20% corn to 80% corn, 20% wheat or something like that?
I think in terms of the last 10 or 15 years, mainly 10 years, since the biofuels revolution that created an entirely new corn market. So that was one thing that changed our whole crop rotation system up here. Second thing, though, and equally, maybe even more important, was as these GMO varieties of corn and soybeans just kept getting better and better and better and more acclimated to shorter growing seasons like the Northern Plains, maybe a little bit less moisture. So we have farmers in central North Dakota that had 200 bushel corn last year. I mean, just think of that compared to 40, 50, 60 bushel wheat. So yes, it did change our marketing focus. I would say the last several years that the majority of our farmers' crops have been corn and soybeans. Wheat, as it's done nationally, it just continued to get smaller and smaller in terms of planted acreage.
There are a few people who grow dryland corn up here in eastern Washington, very few. Do you think it's, corn will ever become a crop up here in the Northwest?
I don't know your climate well enough, but I can tell you that typically in my part of the world, in let's say North Dakota, typical average rainfall, the majority of which, of course, is spring, early summer, is in that 17 to 22 inches. We can get very hot in late June or late July, early August. We have seen some climate change here over the last 25 years. We've been wetter than normal. We've had longer growing seasons, no early frost or late frost in the spring, no early frost in the fall. I just don't know how much more they can do with these genetics in both corn and soybeans, because what they've done has been so phenomenal. And we did a study a few years ago, probably 5 years ago now, for a seed company in Canada. And they're planting in Canada 3 to 4 million acres of corn today, mostly in southern Manitoba, Saskatchewan. But seed companies and others, looking at all what's going on with these new genetics, say that there's no reason Canada can't get to 10, 12 million acres of corn, based on just how much progress has been made. So if that's the case, that would suggest that you could certainly see corn acres increase. I don't know that it's going to ever be a dominant factor, though, in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay. All right. So wheat production in the U.S. has declined from 60 million acres to around 45 million acres this year. I read that winter wheat plantings at 31 million acres would be the lowest since record keeping began in 1919. Is wheat on its way to a minor crop designation, or do you think the crop will bounce back?
I think there's some factors, that long-term factors, that are going to tell the end story of that game. We have lost wheat acres for a couple of reasons. One is just the amazing, as we just talked about, the amazing new products in terms of corn and soybeans that have pushed the wheat belt farther and farther west in North and South Dakota, and even to a lesser extent in Montana. Eastern North Dakota, western Minnesota is now part of the Corn Belt. And it used to be, 20 years ago, was all sunflowers, spring wheat, barley, durum, dry beans. Now it's pretty much corn and beans with an occasional sugar beet and spring wheat acres. The same has happened in Kansas. Eastern Kansas is now basically part of the Corn Belt. Almost all of Nebraska's Corn Belt. So the development of GMO corn and soybeans that have given farmers in these more arid, shorter season growing areas big yields has been maybe the primary factor. Secondary factor is that, Russia for years was our biggest export market. Now this past year, for the first time ever, they exported more wheat to the world than the U.S. So as long as the Black Sea continues to have big crops and they will sell it cheaply, that's going to be problem for U.S. wheat producers. I do think, though, that if you look, the Vince Peterson, who's now the head of U.S. wheat overall, some years ago had an interesting study. Not a really scientific one, but he took a broad brush look at the climatological factors across the Northern Plains, southern Manitoba, southern Saskatchewan, North Dakota, South Dakota, western Minnesota, set that over into to Russia and Ukraine's primary wheat growing regions, and it's almost identical. And I think the point that he was making then that we've actually started to see happen is that if farmers in the Northern Plains shifted more to corn and beans because of genetics and improving weather, why will that not happen in the same, to a similar extent in Russia and Ukraine? So I think the point is that as wheat stays relatively cheap and these corn and soybean markets have their moments, especially soybeans where they're very strong, we will gradually start to see acreages of row crops increase in the Black Sea region as well. I think the other thing is, and I'm not a weather person, but you know, the world has had now seven record total crop production years in a row, almost without a major problem. And it just seems to me that that string is not going to go on indefinitely. And when you look at world ending stocks numbers, they look big on paper, but 50% or more of the world's wheat ending supplies are in China. China doesn't export wheat. So I do think we'll see a rebound in wheat values, and I do think we'll see, you know, a shift back to wheat. We're not going to get back to where we were 15, 20 years ago, but I don't think we see wheat going the way of, you know, oats or barley or sunflowers. And remember, world populations are growing. Demand in Southeast Asia, particularly the high population parts of the world for wheat, expands every single year. And I do believe that one of these days we will see China become a much bigger and more consistent importer of wheat. So I think we climb out of this hole. I just don't know how quickly.
Let me throw in a quality question here. How important is quality? Do you think it's really that important?
You know, it is certainly critical in certain markets. And I think the market for P&W white wheat and good quality spring wheat and good quality hardwood runner wheat, those are the classes of wheat that are gaining a lot of traction in Asia, in Southeast Asia, you know, the growth markets like Indonesia, the Philippines, to a lesser extent, Thailand. Japan's always been a big market. So there we're talking quality. You go to the other side of the world, go to sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, where populations are, you know, exploding, there's no money. Quality just simply is not much of an issue. And to point that out, 2 years ago, I was in Lagos, Nigeria with U.S. Wheat, and there's a company there headquartered in India that has a major pasta-producing facility in Lagos that does not use one kernel of durum. They use the cheapest wheat they can to make the cheapest pasta they can because that's the market they're serving. So, you know, our objective as U.S. wheat farmers and those who market our wheat is we have to continue to cater towards those markets, and you're prime time located to do that, where quality still is and will continue to be a very, very important ingredient.
You mentioned your travels with U.S. Wheat Associates, and I just wondered, I mean, you've been around the world with U.S. Wheat. What is the value of that effort?
You know, I have to say that over the years, and I've told this to our farmer clients, and I've spoken about it at nearly every domestic meeting I've been to, is that I think some farmers have the idea that when your state wheat commission board members or the national U.S. Wheat Associates board members travel to the Philippines or to Egypt or to wherever, to where we bring in all these buyers, consumers of our wheat together for meetings and conferences, I think kind of one of the ideas is, well, that's just a junket and it's a relaxing trip and you get to see the world. And I've done a bunch of them, and it's every bit the opposite. You know, last May, I think I covered, you know, five or six countries in Southeast Asia in 8 days, and one or two meetings a day. And the value is that the grain business, and particularly when we talk about the export business and in those quality markets, it is still a personal relationship business. I mean, they are definitely interested in the people they're buying wheat from. They're interested in meeting the producers who raise that wheat. They have questions for them on the very things you talked about, quality, sustainability, chemical use, all those sorts of things. So I have over the years become a really big proponent of what groups like U.S. Wheat, Grains Council, Soybean Council, all those commodity groups do, because I think it's really contributed. I think that were it not for those market development issues, I mean, we would have a worse struggle with U.S. wheat exports or corn exports or soybean exports today. So I can't emphasize enough how, I mean, I'm a fan of what these people do, and particularly those Americans who live overseas, you know, full time to promote our products. I could not do that.
So let me end with a little silly question here. If you were grain market dictator, is there one trend over your years in the business that you would have liked to have killed in bed?
You know, I thought about that question too, Scott, and you know what the answer is? The answer is I would have killed the ability of major pools of what I call outside or fund money to come into our agricultural markets kind of unabated and take over. And as I mentioned, we're not going to reverse that trend. And in fact, the exchanges are now catering to those groups. But I think that is part of what has made markets, you know, unpredictable and not react to some of the traditional fundamental market makers that we've all grown accustomed to. It's computer-driven money. Their horizon is minutes or seconds or hours. It's not weeks or months or years. And that just has created the kind of volatility and moves both higher and lower that make it difficult to do a better job of marketing than we already are.
Ah, yes. Like the song says, if we could turn back time. But the computerized, anonymous, second-to-second model of grain trading is our reality, and it's not likely to change. If I understand Kruger correctly, technology has made today's USDA reports significantly different from the reports of 20 years ago, partly as a result of fund buying, but also because of technology, which has rendered person-to-person interaction obsolete. In other words, it's not the USDA messing with farmers. It's the entire system that's changed. I hope you've enjoyed episode 180, the show I entitled Older and Wiser, Insight from Money Farm Founder Mike Kruger, 2, about my conversation with the recently retired commodity advisor and Fargo, North Dakota resident. Please join me here again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. Of starvation in times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.